Well, good morning. Next time we'll do a better job knowing what I'm supposed to do on a Sunday. If you would, turn in your Old Testaments to the prophet Jeremiah and chapter 2. Jeremiah chapter 2, and we'll spend the first few minutes of our time together in that text this morning and then leapfrog from there over to our New Testaments. Do you remember when you were younger, when your parents tried to help you learn some life lessons by making comparisons or maybe exaggerations? You know, they would walk into your bedroom and they would say, "It looks like a bomb went off in here." Although there was no bomb, it just looked like one had gone off. You had clothes on the floor and toys all over the place, and your bed was unmade, shoes were scattered, and maybe it was because you came to your mother and said, "I can't find..." And she said, "Well, did you check your room?" "Oh, yeah." And she walked in there and that's what she saw. And there are a lot of phrases that parents use like that. Sometimes there's a phrase that they use, you know, "Were you born in a barn?" And we understand that to mean you left the door wide open. There's actually a skit, go Google it on YouTube, where they flip that around and the entire conversation was backwards. "Were you born in a house? Leave that door open." Jeremiah, in Jeremiah chapter 2, is trying to help the Israelites understand where they were in their relationship with God by making a lot of comparisons. 10 specifically. In the first 8 verses of Jeremiah chapter 2, he makes the comparison that the Israelites were like his wife, but they were an unfaithful wife. So he was trying to help them understand how they had been faithless with him by comparing them to a faithless wife. In verses 9 through 13, God describes them as pursuing broken cisterns. We'll talk about that one in just a minute. In verses 14 through 19, he describes them like they are slaves who have been plundered. In verse 20, he describes them as a stubborn animal. Have you ever heard someone say that someone was mule-headed? That's what we've got going on there. In verse 22, he compares them to a defiled body. In verses 23 through 25, he describes them as instinctual animals. They just do what comes to them naturally. Or as a disgraced thief and incorrigible children in verses 29 through 35. They never listen to their parents. And then finally, in verses 36 through 37, he describes them as prisoners of war. But going back to verses 9 through 13, I'd like to focus on those verses this morning. And it's from those verses that Jesus makes a quotation in a New Testament text. Starting in verse 9, "Therefore I still contend with you, declares the Lord, and with your children's children I will contend. For cross to the coasts of Cyprus and sea, or send to Kedar and examine with care. See if there has been such a thing. Has a nation changed its gods, even though they are no gods? But my people have changed their glory for that which does not profit. Be appalled, O heavens, at this. Be shocked, be utterly desolate, declares the Lord. For my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and hewed out cisterns for themselves, broken cisterns that can hold no water." So this morning, we're going to talk about the contrast between life-giving water and empty cisterns. Now, as we walk down through the text, starting in verse 9, God says, "I have an issue with you, and I'm going to bring it up right now. I'm going to bring it up with all of your descendants." And he issues them a challenge in verse 10. He says, "I want you to look from east to west, as far as you can search, and see if you've ever found someone who has done something like this. Has a nation," in verse 11, "changed its gods, even though they are no gods?" Maybe we're just a little too comfortable with the language that he's using there. Maybe it'd be more fitting, have you ever known an Alabama fan to root for Auburn or vice versa? No. I mean, that's preposterous. I mean, if you had an Alabama fan who had a child that went Auburn, I mean, that'd be a big deal. I think you'd call them a black sheep, or maybe just pretend that they weren't a part of your family. God's saying, this is how preposterous this is. You have a nation exchanging its gods, even though they are no gods. They're changing for things that don't profit. The skies that see everything, in verse 12, are shocked at what Israel has done. And then when you get to verse 13, God gets even more specific about the exchange that they've made. And we're going to spend some time taking verse 13 apart to understand what he's saying. He says, my peoples have committed two evils. They've forsaken me, and he compares himself to fountains of living waters. Clear, fresh, drinkable water. They've forsaken me, and instead hewn out cisterns for themselves, broken cisterns that can hold no water. He's painting a picture here that would be easier for them to visualize back in their day. I mean, when I'm thirsty, I just go to the tap and lift it up and water comes out. Or I go to the refrigerator and push in on the tab and cool, chilled, filtered water comes out of my refrigerator. But what he's describing for the Israelites is a contrast between these clear, living streams, spring water. That's actually a stream from northern Galilee. And he's contrasting that beautiful, pristine water with a broken cistern. Let's see what he says about this water. He says that the comparison is between the water and God. Everyone needs water to survive. And he says that he is what they need. He is what they thirst for. He is what they are rejecting. God is the water. The water is moving and fresh. That's the point of living. And it promotes life. And they've exchanged all of that. They've exchanged all of that for broken cisterns that cannot hold water. What he's trying to have them picture in their mind's eye is this. That is actually a cistern that's under the city of Jerusalem. And typically, with cisterns like that, you would either find a natural depression in the rock, or you would actually go down and carve it out to hold as much water as you needed it to hold. But most of the rock over there is so porous that you've got to plaster the walls so that it retains the water. Or else as much as you pour in, it seeps through the rock and it doesn't hold anything. Well, what happens when you get a crack in that plaster? The water disappears. His point is, they've forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and hewn out cisterns for themselves, broken cisterns that can hold no water. They've gone down and put all of this energy and all of this effort and all of this strength and all of this time into forming and fashioning this thing that would do the job that God ought to be doing for them. And after expending all of that, it failed. It failed. I mean, you contrast those two pictures. When you're really thirsty on a hot day, which of those two places are you going to go? I would go to the first one. I wouldn't go there. The contrast that he's painting is this. They're exchanging the living God for something that's made by man. That is not an equal exchange. That's not an equal exchange. You're exchanging moving fresh water for stagnant and ineffective, and at the end, something that will lead to your death. You don't receive what you need from it. Before we even go there, are you starting to see spiritual parallels? Because that's what God means for us to see. That we exchange our Creator, we exchange our God, we exchange living water for things that we pursue, for things that we do, for things that we put effort and time into. But at the end of the day, it doesn't give us what we need to spiritually survive. You know, there's somebody in the New Testament that Jesus quoted this passage to. And it's over in the Gospel of John, chapter 4. Turn over there. Now, there are a lot of points to be made from John chapter 4, and we're not going to make all of them. We're trying to emphasize the connection between Jeremiah chapter 2 and John chapter 4. In John chapter 4, you have Jesus leave Judea and head toward Galilee, and to get there, he decides to pass through Samaria. And verse 4. You remember from first century history that Samaritans were the Jewish half-breeds that Jews did not particularly care for. And to be fair, the Samaritans did not particularly care for the Jews. We're going to see a little bit of that hostility in the text as we read. In verse 5, Jesus came to a town of Samaria called Sychar, near the field that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there. This place of water that had been attributed to Jacob. So Jesus, wearied as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well. It was about the sixth hour. And a woman from Samaria came to draw water. And Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. Now just to drop a couple of things there. This would have been a unique conversation, and the woman's going to pick up on that in just a second. Jesus is interacting with a woman in a public place. That's not typical for the time. She's going to make mention of that. He's not just interacting with any woman, he's interacting with a Samaritan woman. She's going to make mention of that. And this whole conversation is taking place because he's tired, he's hungry, and he's thirsty. And he sent his disciples into a Samaritan town to find food that would be suitable for them to eat. So in verse 9, the Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, asked for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." And Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God, and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." And we have the reference to Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 13. If you knew the gift of God and who it was that was saying to you, "Give me a drink," you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water. You remember back in Jeremiah chapter 2 that the contrast was God was the water. He was the source of water. He was the water that was being rejected. And Jesus is saying, "I can provide living water," equating himself to God. But she's not quite there. She's not quite on that level. And so the woman in verse 11 said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw water with. The well is deep. Where do you get that living water? This doesn't make sense." And so she challenges him in verse 12. "Are you greater than our father? Are you greater than our father Jacob? He gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did his sons and his livestock." And Jesus said to her, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life." And that sounded so good to her that she said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come to draw water again." Do you recognize what's going on in those verses, verses 7 through 15, when Jesus initiates that conversation with a Samaritan woman? He's initiating a conversation with somebody who was spiritually dying of thirst. He was initiating a conversation with someone that did not have the relationship with God that they needed to have. So what would the next step be? And she's still not there. She still doesn't quite get what the spiritual water is that he's offering. She's still thinking, whatever you're offering, I don't want to have to keep walking out here and lowering a bucket and bringing it back up and carrying it back into town. If you can save me all of that work, give me that water. She still hasn't made the connection. So Jesus has to do some work. The first thing that he's done is initiated the conversation with someone dying of thirst. Start again in verse 16. She has just said, "Sir, give me this water." And you would think the natural response to that would have been, "Sure, I am he." But that's not what he does. In verse 16, he said to her, "Go, call your husband and come here." Why did Jesus do that? We know from other places in the Gospels that Jesus knows what's going on. Jesus knows what goes on inside the hearts of the people that he's interacting with. Jesus demonstrates his omniscience. Jesus is not foolish. He initiates another part of the conversation knowing where it's going to go. And by bringing up her marital status, look at what she says in verse 17. The woman answered him, "I have no husband." This really short, brief, we're going to end this part of the conversation right here. But Jesus says to her, "You are right in saying, 'I have no husband,' for you have had five husbands, and the one you now have is not your husband. What you have said is true." Why did he do that? Remember the contrast between living water versus broken cisterns. Instead of pursuing God, instead of finding my fulfillment in God, I find fulfillment in things other than God. Sometimes I find my fulfillment in beings, in people, in relationships other than God. What has this woman made her life's work? She's been going from one husband to the next husband to the next husband to the next husband. And she currently is with somebody who isn't even her husband, but she's got a man. And if we were Dr. Phil, Jesus would have said, "How's that working for you? Are you finding fulfillment? Are you finding what you're looking for in that relationship?" The answer is no, because you're on to number six. Do you realize what Jesus is doing here? He's helping her identify the broken cisterns that she's been hewing out for herself. She's been digging out this well in relationships that's broken, that cannot satisfy. And Jesus is helping her to recognize that. But he's not done. She tries to get off of that subject in verse 19 by saying, "Sir, I perceive that you're a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." We'll stop there, because both of them had some lengthy sentences. The woman swerves from her marital status and jumps into religion. You know, one of those two things you're not supposed to talk about. Politics and religion. She goes to religion. And she says, "So what do you think about religion? You're a Jew, I'm a Samaritan, we believe we should worship up here, you believe you should worship down there. What do you think about that?" And do you realize the perspective that Jesus puts on that? He says, "You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know." And from that perspective, he says, your worship has been one of your broken cisterns. You've been worshiping the way you want to worship, based on your traditions, not based on God's revelation. Your worship and your manner of worship and where you worship has been all about you. been made by man. He's trying to identify her cisterns. Your relationships, you're not finding fulfillment in that. The way you worship, you're not doing that right either. But he doesn't end with that. He says, let me give you some perspective on that. There's a certain type of person that God is seeking to worship him. And then when you get to verses 25 and 26, the woman said to him, I know the Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. And when he comes, he will tell us all things. And finally, after that whole lengthy conversation, Jesus gets down to saying, I who speak to you am he. I'm the prophesied Messiah. I'm the one who can tell you all things. I am the living water. And then when the disciples come back, they marvel at this conversation that he's having. She runs off to tell everybody in town. Everybody in town comes out and interacts with Jesus. Do you see what Jesus did through all of that? Jesus reaches out to somebody who's dying of spiritual thirst. What would you do if you were in one of the deserts that we have here on the planet, and you happen to have a bunch of water with you, and you see someone crawling and grasping through the sand, and you recognize this person's about to die of dehydration? They might see three of me. They might see pink elephants. I don't know, because they could be hallucinating from dehydration. But you have all of this water. What would you do? And Jesus, recognizing her spiritual thirst, reaches out to her and starts a conversation. And you know the cartoons that we watched as kids when there were animals out in the desert and they were hallucinating because of dehydration, and they'd go to get a drink from a water fountain, but it really wasn't a water fountain, it was a cactus. But they thought it was giving them water because they were just there out of their mind. What Jesus does is he helps this woman identify where she has been going for her satisfaction and pointing out it's not working. It's not working. You are not going to find satisfaction there, and you're not going to find satisfaction there. And then where he ends up is, I am what you are looking for. I'm it. I am where you need to go to quench that thirst. What do we do with that? What do we do with Jeremiah's warning to Israel back in Jeremiah chapter 2? Jesus' use of it over in John 4. What do we do with all of that? This is what we should do. Just like that woman at the well, do you recognize your need for spiritual provision and sustenance? Are you tired of digging and carving and plastering for poor quality water or a lack of it? I mean, it takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of effort to dig out those cisterns. But you think about what you put into the same process when you turn away from God and look for fulfillment someplace else. How many sleepless nights do you spend? How many hours awake? How much money? How much time? What relationships do you sacrifice in order to get what you think will fulfill you, but it does not? When I think about that point and the effort of carving out and digging your own cistern, I can't help but think about Proverbs 13:15 that says, the way of the transgressor is hard. When we go our own way and try to fill ourselves with something that is not God, it takes a toll. It's difficult. It makes life harder. If you're there, then the second question is, what broken cisterns have you been trying to find satisfaction in? Jesus helps the Samaritan woman identify two in her life. She's looking for satisfaction in relationships with men. I've got to have a man. Guess what? God never promised that everybody would be married. He did not. Paul actually encouraged some folks over in 1 Corinthians to live as he lived, which was as a single man. Right? But this woman had to have a man. And that didn't work. Or she was going to worship the way that the Samaritans thought to worship, even though that worship was wrong. All of us need to evaluate our worship that way. Are we worshiping the way that God has prescribed in spirit and in truth? Or are we worshiping him the way we want in this man-made effort? Maybe it's another area. Maybe for you, it's having a certain number in your bank account. And until you hit that, you're just going to keep going and going and going. Maybe it's a sport or a plethora of sports. Whatever it is, what are you pursuing and exchanging in the place of God? You remember what Jesus said over in Matthew chapter 6 about all of that? In Matthew chapter 6, starting in verse 19, this is Christ's Sermon on the Mount. Jesus said, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." What do you pursue as most important here? If it's a relationship with God, then you're going to be satisfied. You're going to have your spiritual needs met. But if you're living for earthly things, you're not going to find satisfaction in that. And it's not going to go with you. What else? Well, from where Jesus was, this woman was tired of digging. And Jesus helps her identify what she had been pursuing, what she'd been looking for. And by his declaration, "I am he," he's helping her to realize you can have your spiritual needs met right here. Right here. And you don't even have to leave the Sermon on the Mount. You remember in the Beatitudes over in Matthew chapter 5, where Jesus says, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied." You will only find that satisfaction in Jesus. Only there. But you have to recognize your hunger and thirst for him first. And I love this point. I love this point. And this was intentional on Matthew's part. This was intentional on the Spirit's part. Do you remember back in Matthew chapter 4, before he actually kicks off his ministry? In chapter 3, you had the baptism of Jesus. Chapter 4, you have the temptation of Jesus, where he is out in the wilderness for 40 days and nights being tested by Satan for all of those 40 days, according to Luke. But we only read about a handful of the temptations. And you remember, while he was out there for those 40 days and 40 nights, he fasted, didn't eat. How do you imagine he felt at the end of the 40th day? It wasn't just a little gurgle. The word in verse 2 was, he was hungry. He was hungry. And Satan uses that to launch into the temptations that we have revealed to us, saying, "Hey, if you're hungry, look, just turn these stones into bread and eat." Do you realize it's that word for hungry that Jesus uses in Matthew chapter 5 when he says, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst." When you want your relationship as badly as Jesus wanted a sandwich after fasting for 40 days, then you're hungry for God. He's not talking about, "I could go for a snack. I'm feeling a little peckish." That is not what Jesus is describing. He says that when your desire for Jesus becomes the all-consuming thing, those people have that need satisfied. And they have it satisfied in Christ. If you have come to Christ, you recognize that he's going to meet those needs, that he is the living water that you need to quench your thirst. You come to him. Have you told others that they can do the same thing? Do you glorify his name so that others come to recognize their need and come to have their thirst met? I was listening to a lesson on what it meant to glorify God. And it was a great lesson. And the guy was a very visual guy. He liked to use his hands and move around. It's just, that's the way he taught. And as he was asking the question, what does it mean to glorify God? To help others come to know how great God is. He gave this great illustration. I just didn't care for the particulars. He said, "My wife loves Diet Mountain Dew. This is not my soda of choice, but it's the illustration he gave. He said she starts every morning with a can of Diet Mountain Dew. Someone might want to talk to her about addictions and things like that. But for her, it was Diet Mountain Dew instead of coffee. Right? And that if she had been outside in the heat, working and sweating, that what satisfied her more than anything else was a cold can of Diet Mountain Dew. And he said, you need to see her. You ought to watch her. When she comes in from the hot, muggy outside, and she goes to the fridge, and she opens the door, and she takes the can out, and he just happened to have a can of Diet Mountain Dew. And he said, you can hear her pop the top, and he pops it, and you hear that pop. And when she is really thirsty, she doesn't even hesitate. She drinks the whole thing. And so he stands there and kind of rears back, and and about halfway through, you're like, he's not taking a breath. And he drank the whole can in one go. And when he was done, he set it down with authority and let out this. And all of us just sat there going, where is he going with all of this? And he let that just hit us for a couple of seconds. And he said, odds are right now you are probably craving your favorite drink. Because what I just did for the last 2 or 3 minutes was I glorified Mountain Dew. I told you that on a daily basis I have a need or a craving for this. Whether it's real or imagined, I have this craving. And that every day I can only have that craving met with this. And that when I come to have it met, it's just an incredible experience. It's refreshing. And I enjoy it. And I communicate my enjoyment by when I'm done, I let you know it met the need. Ah. And by the time I'm done, you're ready for yours. Do you realize when we're called on to glorify God, we're called on to glorify Christ. That's what we're being called on to do. When we say, I have this spiritual need and it needs to be met, and I can only meet it in Jesus. And when I go to Jesus, and whether it's for forgiveness or whether it's for encouragement or whether it's for instruction, every time I go, even though there are times where it's difficult, even though there are times where it's challenging and it builds my faith, by the time the process is done, my need is met, and Jesus is more than satisfactory. And by the time I'm done talking to you about my Lord, you start to question, I think I might need Jesus. And maybe that's where I need to go, because these other things do not satisfy. These other things are shells. They are empty, worn-out shells that do not have any substance. Are you having your spiritual thirst quenched by Jesus? And if so, then you ought to be communicating that in a way that other thirsty, dying people are intrigued to come try Him and have that need met. I love Jesus' use of Jeremiah chapter 2. If you are not a Christian yet, you've been living life your way and you've been digging wells that are empty, stop it. Because you will not find satisfaction at the end of that thing. We met some friends a couple of years ago in Arizona that had some boys about Kenan's age. And there's no grass. There's no grass in Arizona, especially Phoenix. And they pointed us to their backyard and they said, you see back there? And there were mounds of dirt in the backyard. They said, what's going on back there? You have some plumbing issues? What's going on? And they said, no, our boys are just digging. I said, well, how far are they going? We don't know. Well, why are they digging it? To see what they could dig. And so there was this pit, and the kids could jump in and duck down, and they disappeared. It was a pointless hole. An exercise in futility. that when they got tired enough and hot enough, they just stopped. And they had this big old hole in the backyard. Kids, do not go home and do that. Parents, if they do, it's not my fault. There's nothing there. There's nothing there. If that's where you are, come to Jesus. Stop digging in those holes that don't go anywhere and find your satisfaction in Him. If you are a Christian, but you have become distracted by things that do not satisfy, and that's going to go on for the rest of our lives. Satan is going to try to distract us, thinking, you just need Jesus and this. Or Jesus and, it's going to be Jesus and, not Jesus or. Don't buy into that. What you need is Jesus. We sing the song, In Christ Alone. That's what you need. You need Jesus. If you need to become a Christian and be buried with Christ in baptism, to be raised to walk in newness of life, to follow Him as your Lord, you can do that this morning. If there's somebody that is a Christian that has not been pursuing Him, that's been pursuing other things, and you need prayers of encouragement, you can do that this morning by letting us know what your need is, by coming up to the front row while we stand and sing the song of invitation.